Peter, please. The court is ready to hear argument now in 090223, Sherrilyn Water Supply Corporation versus City of Alton and others.
Court, Mr. Dyer will present argument for the petitioner. The petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Please, the court.
Normally, I wouldn't start out by talking about the facts.
Okay, but I think that the court needs to have a firm grip on the position that Sherrilyn finds itself in, because I think that this court is one that's supposed to indicate to the citizens of the state how they're supposed to conduct business and how they're supposed to act. And I have no idea how Sherrilyn could have acted any different than they did. In the 1970s, late 60s, early 70s, Sherrilyn Water Supply Corporation was formed by the residents of the rural communities with some government funding to provide water service to the rural communities in the rural area.
Within this
area was a community that was later to become Alton. In the 80s, the City of Alton incorporated, and in so doing decided that they wanted to try to expand their facilities and promote growth within the city, and so they came and they asked Sherrilyn if they were to get federal funding to put in some more water lines, would Sherrilyn take over those water lines and provide water service? Sherrilyn's policy was to provide water service to existing customers, and they wanted to promote growth, and they wanted to put in water lines so they could have new customers, as well as provide fire service to the area, as well as provide water to their own facility. And Sherrilyn had entered into an agreement, a series of agreements with them. They used the federal funding, the city used the federal funding to put in more water lines. They gave those water lines to Sherrilyn along with easements. They entered into service agreements and water supply agreements with Sherrilyn, whereby Sherrilyn would provide those services. Sherrilyn had no obligation to provide fire service water, but they did so. At the time that all this was done, the state of the law was the MOPAC versus Brownsville Navigation District. Sue and be sued meant that the city could be sued. There was not any requirement that consequential damages would not be allowed or attorney's fees would not be allowed. And in fact, when the sewer lines were built, that was the status of the law. When the water lines were built, that was the status of the law. When the sewer lines that are the heart of this case were built, that was the status of the law. When this lawsuit was filed, that was the status of the law. And when it went to trial, that was the status of the law. So that was the only thing that Sherrilyn knew that it was going to be operating under. But we find ourselves in a little bit of a quandary now, because we got stuck in the middle, because there was a realization in Took that sue and be sued didn't mean that it had waived governmental immunities to sue. And so we sit here today faced with that. The changes that the legislature made don't really address the situation that Sherrilyn's in. Sherrilyn is not asking for money for services that it's rendered. And that's the type of situation that the legislation that followed Took, Local Government Code 271.151 and so on, covers. We're asking for performance. We're asking that the state laws to protect the public health be followed.
Well, let me ask you this. The failure of the project, as you assert, is the construction of the sewer lines affecting the water lines. How did that affect the value of your property interest in what Sherrilyn owned?
You know, it's not like you go out and you sell a water system and it has a value. The problem is that you have an untenable situation that has to be changed, and so the value, I guess, the diminution in value is what's it going to take to make it right. You either move the water line or you insulate the water line by putting steel casing around it or some other remedy that is allowed under Chapter 290 of the Water Code. You can't leave it like it is. That's the problem. Normally this situation might be an inverse condemnation type thing, because you'd leave it that way and the city would say, okay, now We have taken that right and you would pay for that right. But you can't leave it that way.
But as I understand it, that you own the water system, the easements and so forth, by virtue of a grant from the City of Alton.
And some private easement, yes, sir. And that is, and so when you start talking about issues with respect to the normal scenario, you'd either have, this isn't a temporary situation, so you don't have a temporary damage type situation. You don't have an inverse condemnation situation because you can't leave it the way that it is. I mean, so it really speaks for equitable relief.
Is there evidence that this kind of contamination ever happens? I know that it has.
There was some evidence. If you're talking about contamination, because part of the argument was, well, look, you got a pressurized water line, and you got a non-pressurized sewer line. So how are you going to get sewer in the water? And the testimony was that there are occasions, primarily when there's water line breaks, that you don't know are there, because that happens. You have a water line break, the water's coming out, but it's going down in the ground faster than it's going up, so it never comes to the surface, you don't see it. There was testimony about how in 1989 there was a freeze and it froze all the pumps on the water system, and as a result, the upper section of the system drained downward, actually drained out of water, and drained into the lower section. And Alton happens to be on the higher section. So if you have a water line leak, and you have sewer that's been leaking around it, as was found in one occasion, then you are going to introduce sewage into the line.
If the pumps quit.
If the pumps go, or whatever causes the pressure in the system to go down. Now, the other situation is when you know you have a leak on a system. I know that between here and a half mile away I have a leak and I have to take that line down. Now these sewer lines are not marked. They're not made of metal. No one knows exactly where they are. No one knows which ones are leaking and which ones aren't leaking. So now I'm going to go out there and I'm going to repair a line. So I start digging down. What am I going to hit first? I'm going to hit the sewer line first because it's on top. And it's not marked. There's no way of knowing it.
But the
odds are I'm going to break that sewer line.
The only places that it's on top are the side laterals going off to the homeowners?
That's correct. You have a main water line, you have a main sewer line, and everywhere where they've decided to put a stub off so that later sewer service could be connected in, they came up, went over the water line, and went to the right-of-way line and plugged it. Now, some of those presumably are used, and some of those are presumably unused. And so, yes, to the extent that you're going to say, well, if there's a house over there, then you know there's a sewer line somewhere in here. Well, that's true, but where? Is it on this side of the property? On that? See, what they did was most of these houses had septic tanks. A few of them had outhouses. Most of them had septic tanks or cesspools. And those were to be decommissioned and a line run out to the new sewer line. We don't know where those septic tanks were. And the fact of the matter is when we were going out to try to locate these, even though it was only a few months after they had been put in, it was still difficult to find them. And now, after several years, it's even more difficult to find them. But yes, I mean, you know they're within 100 feet of somewhere, but you don't know, is it here or is it over there? And when you're digging, I mean, you've got a man down there, he's trenching, he's trying to poke around and find that, and you're using a backhoe, and invariably, you're going to hit something. If you hit it, this is not, see, that's why they put... That's why they don't say you can't put sewer lines on top of water lines. They say you can, but you got to take certain protections. Excuse me. Because this is what's going to happen. And sewer lines, these sewer lines are not made out as heavy a product as is required if you're going to do it right, for the very reason that backhoe is going to probably hit it and nick it, and then you're going to have a leak. So that's the situation, the reality that they've got to deal with. So really, honestly, from the very beginning, all Shareland wanted was them to put it in right. And when they bowed their neck, said, no, we're not, we're charging on, and we're doing it just this way, then Shareland had nothing to do but bring a suit and try to require specific performance. And during the temporary injunction hearing, counsel said, if there's something wrong, we'll fix it. We don't think there's anything wrong with 317. I didn't really think that Section 317, now 217, was really the focus of things until I read this morning a little blurb that's in the informational packet, and it seems like that some of the staff, and they are, they're challenging whether 317, now 217, applies. I want to point out one thing. Even if this court were to say, you know what, 317 doesn't apply, now being 217, doesn't apply to this section. I mean, when you do that, what you do is you take a part of the entire system of sewage from the commode or the sink to the discharge stream on the sewer plant, and you say there's a little piece in here that's unregulated. Because right now, under the current reading of the law, it's regulated. You've got local plumbing codes that deal with it on personal property. Once it gets on the public property, the TCQ regulations apply. And if you say, no, this one doesn't apply, it still doesn't solve the problem. Because the issue before the court was not just the application of 317, but also did it meet engineering standards, the normal, everyday engineering standards in industry practices. And the finding was that it didn't meet those as well, because even as the TCQ representatives that testified said, 317 at least is the industry standard, is at least the engineering standard that should be applied. So simply saying 317 doesn't apply still doesn't resolve the problem, because they breached the standards that apply in public anyway. It's my position it does apply.
Is it, to you, it's your position, it has to be your position that the city was required to do certain things under the code when putting in the sewer system.
They were.
And, of course, you had a contract with the city to supply water.
We had several contracts with the city, yes.
So by their failure to comply with the code, that would be your allegations of breach of the contract they had with you.
That's correct.
Well, if the city, by acting through its sewer director, you know, lacking another term to use here, failed to perform those things, couldn't Sherryland have sued the city official in charge of doing this and required through some of the injunctive procedures or something to force that person to comply with the act?
If such a person actually existed, there was no such person. That's why they sued the city.
But there is a city official involved. The mayor.
The city council had authorized this work, had hired these engineers to basically take care of doing those aspects of it. In other words, making sure that the work was being done right. The field engineer took TCB was the one that was supposed to be looking in the trench, make sure that it was being done right. And Carter Burgess was supposed to be looking over their shoulders and make sure they were doing their job and make sure that it was getting paid right and that everything was meeting the codes and the standards. They basically subcontracted out that work to those individuals.
I guess I'm looking for a remedy. You know, as you described when you first started about the situation with respect to the sovereign immunity or the governmental immunity situation, what remedies do companies like yours have under these circumstances? The court appeal said that you don't have a damages remedy here.
On the immunity issue, if you say we got caught in the cracks between the realization in Took that sue and be sued doesn't mean that, then all I can tell from looking at the current rulings that this court has made is that you look at conduct. Well, what was the conduct here? What was the different conduct? And I know that y'all have said that simply signing a contract, that's not enough. Simply retaining the benefits alone and maybe arguing about how much you should be paid or paid for it, that's not enough. But in this case, it was more than that. They were told they were doing it. First of all, they're violating the statute. Second of all, or a regulation. Second of all, they are, after it's pointed out to them, then they say, you know what? At first they say you're right, and they go to the engineers and the contractor and they say make it right. And for some strange reason, all of a sudden it comes back and says, no, we're not going to make them do that. They can do it that way. I guess when I say strange reason, I understand that the engineers went and said, look, we don't think 317 applies. But when you start looking at why they said 317 applies, it makes no sense. The only reason that the TCQ officials that they talked to, who happened to be good friends of theirs, said 317 applied. When you took their deposition, the only reason they said it didn't apply was because if they took the position and applied, it was going to, they couldn't handle the workload. That was the only response. And in addition to that, if you look at the section of 317 that I'm referring to, it not only has regulations about how you, the spacing differences, but it also has regulations in that same area, same section, not off somewhere else, about the type of pipe that you can use and the grades that you're going to have, that you're going to use. And this was really covered deeply in the motion for summary judgment on the 317, and so questions related to it really can be answered there. But their response, when I asked them, so if it doesn't apply, if sewer doesn't mean this particular place, these stub outs, if they're not covered, then that means that that they can be made out of anything. They could be made out of paper. He says, no. You have to make them this way. Here's the standard. It's right in the next paragraph.
Does the city have one official, one official that's responsible for this, or is it the whole council?
I was not aware that there was, no one ever took the position that there was a person at the city that was responsible, and I'm not aware of one. They had hired the engineers to oversee this and take care of it. And they were, and my understanding was they were, the city manager, I guess, would be the only person. And quite honestly, if we had realized that we needed to do something different to trigger some of this, I think their conduct at trial would have been different. If we'd have known we needed to sue an individual, or if we'd have known, you know what, we're not providing any fire protection anymore, we're just cutting you off, the city would have sued us. The city did sue us. The city sued us to recover these easements and these pipes. And so, under that, I believe they've waived their immunity.
Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Dyer. The court is now ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court. Mr. Tatum and Ms. Leeds will present argument for the respondents. Ms. Leeds will open with the first 5 minutes.
May it please the court, counsel. I would first like to address the issue of the officials, because I believe Justice Green and Johnson are going to maybe El Paso versus Heimerich. And whether or not, if this is an equitable claim, do you have a city official against whom you could have asserted an equitable claim and gotten specific performance? At the time, I.T. Davey was the law, and that says the same thing as El Paso versus Heinrich. It still says if you sue a city official, you can still get the same relief. No city official was ever sued. The thing that occurred in this case is that Sherryland came to the city, said, you're doing it wrong. The city went to its engineers and said, hey, Sherryland is saying you're doing it wrong. The engineers went to the TNRCC and asked them to determine whether we were doing it wrong. Everybody said, it's not being done wrong. 317.13, a regulation, does not apply to what Sherryland is complaining about.
Were there industry standards that it was not in compliance with?
No. The TNRCC, who tells us how to do it, said this was in compliance with their standards.
So
pipes that were being complained of, this regulation doesn't apply to them.
Are there engineering standards or industry standards outside of 317 that this project is not in compliance with?
No.
So the city not worried about contaminated water?
The city was not, because it was asking its experts, and they were asking their experts. All of the information the city got was that it's in compliance, and in the trial, one of the experts came in and testified as to the, Mr. Dyer said that the kind of plumbing that was being used was not good enough. Well, the testimony was that it was a Cadillac system. The pipes they used were, I believe, 220 PSI pipes for these laterals that are coming from one house. They have no pressure in them at all. And the piping that was being used is for pressurized water. And so he testified that he didn't believe any of these pipes unless somebody actually went down and broke one, they would ever have reason to break.
How is sewage getting in the water supply, or do you disagree that that's happening?
It is not. It has never happened. There has never been one single leak that has been found, except for when Sherryland went out and started digging up for purposes of the lawsuit, they found one leak, and it wasn't in the pipes that we're talking about. It was actually in a yard. A gasket had rolled, and the belief was that it was leaking because of the digging up. Not one other instance has occurred since this land has been pushed back to rest. No damages, no water contamination at all.
You said it's a cat?
Justice Johnson?
You said it's a Cadillac system, but didn't the jury find for Sherryland in this case?
Yes, they did.
So they apparently didn't buy the Cadillac system story.
Correct.
Okay.
And if it does happen sometime down the road that some residents of the city complain about contaminated water, get sick, come to the city and complain about that, who are you going to point to?
Who are we going to point to?
As being the blame for it. Can't be Sherryland.
No, it couldn't be Sherryland because they, you know, obviously I don't think they'd point to anybody. They'd fix it. The problem is that all of the experts agreed that in order, because of the pipes at issue are unpressurized, even though they tried to at first during part of the trial argued that these house laterals were pressurized and would blow up if they broke. These are unpressurized pipes taking wastewater from one house. Because these pipes have so little in them, there would have to be a break in the pipe in very close proximity to a pressurized water line. The experts testified that for the likelihood of that pressurized water line to have a crack in it, a break in it, and have suffered negative pressure such that it would be sucking in the sewage instead of blowing out its water would be just, you know, so unlikely as to be unheard of. And not one of them, not one of the experts, had ever heard of such a thing happening. Not one. So the probability of this leaking of a house lateral getting into a water main, a pressurized water main, was virtually improbable.
And does that is that a different circumstance when they're digging or when there is a problem and because of the proximity and the type of material used, though, because there's this huge potential out there for a serious problem if there's some digging that takes in place?
No. If there is some digging, then it depends on what they're digging for. If they're digging because a water line has broken, water should be spewing out because it's pressurized. And so all of the protections that are in water, the pressure, the chlorination, the anti-contamination materials that they have anyway, is likely, most likely, to not be contaminated down the line. Because they're going to cut the water off before. If this water line breaks and they go digging and they break a sewer line, it's not going to go anywhere because the water has been cut off. And the experts testified the likelihood of this happening is just highly improbable, that all the pieces would line up.
If that's the case, then why this regulation?
Because it's talking about water mains and sewer mains. They don't want the collection tubes of the sewers that have a lot more sewage in them in close proximity with the water mains. And I believe 217 addresses that. The new regulation addresses the fact that these regulations go to the collection pipes and not the single, you know, well, nothing in the house.
317 says water line.
Pardon?
317 says water line.
Right.
Doesn't say main.
No. And it that now is 217.
Well, okay, but it still says water line.
Correct.
So back to my question, if there's just virtually no likelihood of something like this ever happening, why have the regulation in the first place?
Well, because the TNRCC said that's the way we interpret it, that's the way we look at it
thought it was important.
The TNRCC thought it was important, and that's the way they interpreted it, that it did not apply to the kinds of house laterals that were being that were at issue.
Let me ask you a fact question. These all involve PVC piping, and so there's no cast iron, which obviously breaks.
Time left, but I just wanted to quickly address the immunity issue.
You will use your co-counsel's time, but that's all right for to us.
A minute. Mr. Dyer was incorrect in terms of how the Court of Appeals applied immunity. The Court of Appeals waived immunity for the City of Alton, and you know, all of the discussion that plaintiffs went through, or appellants went through on, you know, how they gave Alton immunity is just not relevant, because the Court of Appeals waived immunity and applied the statute 271, 153, and, you know, related statutes the way this court has told it to apply. So we would ask that you affirm the Court of Appeals. Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel.
It pleases the court, Steve Tatum on behalf of the design professionals that were defendants in the court below and successful appellants in the Court of Appeals. I want to take my time to discuss the issues that are particularly relevant to the design industry that were raised in this case, the economic loss rule and its application by the Court of Appeals, and the issues relating to a portion of appellant's written presentation regarding a duty issue that the Sherryland Water Supply Corporation felt was raised in this case. I want to start with the economic loss rule, though. This case really is a classic example of why the economic loss rule exists and why this court has recognized its existence in years past. I recognize there's been no writing on that for some time from this body, but
it's not clear about privity.
Excuse me?
It's not clear about privity.
It isn't clear about privity. The issue regarding privity, I think the problem with eliminating or with restricting the operation of the economic loss rule to parties in privity is that it would swallow the rule. Quite frankly, the whole purpose of the economic loss rule is to allow parties in commercial situations. I mean, there are several justifications for it, but the main reason for it is to allow parties in commercial situations to provide for risk, contractually or otherwise, with insurance. If the economic loss rule was restricted to parties that already have a contract with each other, presumably they've already provided for whatever risks are involved in their relationship in that contract, then there's no purpose for the rule, because the rule will have, I mean...
There's a purpose to address it in the contract, to be sure it's addressed in... The purpose is to be sure it's addressed in the contract. For example, in a products case, you want to make sure that the manufacturer and the purchaser have, if they're worried about the risk of it blowing up, they should address that in the contract. They can do that. But how can parties who are not, don't have a contract, address those issues? Your point is they should go get one.
Well, there's two responses to that. In the first place, it particularly in the situation that we're looking at here involving construction projects with many participants, one-on-one contracts between different levels of service providers and artisans and so forth. Several states have recognized that that milieu, that combination of one-to-one contracts, effectively and efficiently provides for risk allocation and so forth, even though a party to a contract with a party over here has no privity at all with a contractor on a different aspect of the project.
Why should you use the economic loss rule when you could use the Hadley rule? And it seems like the economic loss rule is sort of heavy-handed in that, as you say, milieu, and that it would the more efficient way to cabin in the duties that people are going to owe each other is through the old Hadley rule, that you're not responsible for unforeseeable consequences.
Well, because there has to be some risk allocation, and I think
Hadley does that. He does some of that.
Well, if unforeseen consequences in commercial...
Instead of looking at the kinds of damages, it does look at the kind of damages, but it looks at foreseeability, and why isn't that a better restriction, if you will, on unlimited duty than the economic loss rule?
Because foreseeability, there is potentially no limit to what is foreseeable from a particular circumstance. For example, a contractor on an apartment building, because of the actions of a negligent subcontractor, that building's completion is delayed. A person who had a lease to enter that building and set up a residence in that building is delayed because the building is delayed. That person is faced with delay penalties where that person is living and so forth. The building is faced with potential penalties from the lessee that was going to come in and replace the person.
It never ends.
And you can't end.
But now, why doesn't Hadley take it?
And all of those are foreseeable.
Well, foreseeable really. In the sense that under the rule that everything's going to go wrong, it's kind of foreseeable. But it's hard to expect that a subcontractor should know that a tenant's finish-out contractor is going to be delayed and not paid because of work that the subcontractor doesn't do right.
Well, that's true. But without the economic loss rule, that subcontractor would have to try to anticipate those things. And that's the problem. The way the economic loss rule works out is it's the nature of the damage and not foreseeability that it depends upon. That's easily determinable. It's fairly clear in a commercial situation whether damages are commercial or property damage or bodily injury. It's pretty simple to figure that out. And so you don't have a potential jury issue in every single piece of litigation arising out of a commercial delay situation where a jury has to find out whether it was or has to determine whether this particular step in the damage chain was foreseeable or whether it's the next one. And there's really no principled way to draw a line. It has to be, in my view. I mean, I think it's if the first delayed lessee is foreseeable but the second isn't, that's an arbitrary distinction.
But the problem with the economic loss rule in that context is that if you do actually know that economic loss is imminent, you're told. Look, if you don't get to work, we're going to have this loss and we're going to hold you responsible, the economic loss rule would cut them off when the Hadley rule wouldn't.
Well, again, the economic loss rule would encourage the discussion of those issues up front so that we wouldn't wind up in a courthouse every time.
You can't have a contract with somebody that doesn't want a contract.
Well, that's true. But in a construction situation like the one we're faced with here, different parties deal with different aspects of the risk that something like that's going to go wrong. And the economic loss rule in jurisdictions all over the United States, including this court, has basically been recognized as an efficient way to encourage economic activity and to permit at least quantification of risk involved. The economic loss rule, so we believe that this court's earlier jurisprudence and guidance from jurisdictions all over the United States that have adopted the economic loss rule in situations regardless of privity is a is from a policy standpoint and from a legal standpoint the appropriate disposition of this issue, and the Court of Appeals got that right.
You said that our earlier jurisprudence supports the economic loss rules application as you see it. Have we ever held, this court ever held that? It looks like there's Courts of Appeals opinions, Fifth Circuit. Has this court ever so held?
Well, it has been observed. Dean Powers has observed in an article that was written some time ago that the this court in several of the early Nobility Homes being one of them, that sort of a precursor to or an application of a doctrine similar to the economic loss rule. This court has actually never expressly adopted the economic loss rule in this type of situation. So this would be an issue of first impression, at least as far as clarity is concerned.
Sometimes a loss in value can be shown by cost of repair.
Right.
Why isn't the evidence of cost of repair here some evidence of property damage for purposes of the economic loss rule? The Court of Appeals held it wasn't. I'm just not sure why.
Well, simply because it is, in cases under every jurisdiction that's looked at this, the cost of repair to the object of the contract itself is an economic loss, not property damage, held to be property damage. If in the course of digging the trench to lay the sewer line, someone had knocked the water main that was right next to it, broken it or something, that's obviously property damage. But that hasn't happened, and in the many years that this system has been in place, side by side with the freshwater system, there has been not one instance of any type of property damage or bodily injury.
So if the sewage were to get into the water system, and we had a lot of people sick in Alton, then you could be sued.
But that would be bodily injury.
You can't be sued now because that's bodily injury.
Yes, sir.
You can't prevent it. No one could make you keep from making those people sick, but they can sue you after they get sick, is your position.
Well, our position is that...
Well, that has to be your position, it seems like. Then you have personal injury. We have to wait for people to get sick and die before anyone can sue your client.
That's the way the tort system works in this state. There has to be damage. There has to be some damage. There's never, there isn't a situation that I'm aware of in which this court has allowed recovery of injuries for a damage or damages for an injury that might occur in the future sometime. In the Pustahovsky case that this court handed down several years ago involving asbestosis and mesothelioma, this court didn't allow or didn't approve of the recovery of damages for the worst disease unless and until that worst disease manifested itself.
But the court also said they can go forward with the asbestosis claim, and then later, if mesothelioma developed, they could go forward with that claim as well.
Exactly. And my point being that you couldn't get the damage until it occurred, at least in that circumstance. That's not a tight analogy, but I think it's at least an indication that this court and the tort system in this state has always depended on the existence of injury before there's been an ability to recover tort damages for that injury. This system may never fail. It hasn't failed yet. It may probably never will fail. As was pointed out earlier, the regulations that were alleged to have been violated by this construction have been approved, and the actual construction was viewed on site by representatives of the TNRCC, and they approved it and said it didn't need to be redone or replaced or any such thing. I believe that under those circumstances, the The economic loss rule here, it's a very clear application. I think the Court of Appeals got it right, and I believe that this Court should affirm.
Thank you, Counsel.
Mr. Dyer, I don't want to take away from your legal analysis, but you said at the beginning that the facts were very important here, and you gave us the facts. I could not help but notice that you appeared to disagree with Ms. Leeds' statements about some of the facts that the engineering experts testified that there can never be any cross-contamination. Now, having had the experience of dropping sewage tanks and then later cutting them off and dropping a sewage line to tie into a main and then laying the water line on top of that, just generally how it's done, I believe, that the sewage pipes at the bottom, the water lines at the top, and they connect into the main line. You seem to not agree with her statement that there can never ever be a cross-contamination there. If that's the case, I'd like to hear your thoughts on it, because I'm no expert on the field, but I disagree as well.
If a water system is leaking, there was plenty of testimony that water systems leak and you don't know where the leak is because it goes down in the ground, doesn't surface. If you're going across a piece of sand or whatever, often times happens. If in the course of needing to repair a line, for whatever reason, there's a break or whatever, you take large sections of line out of service at a time. You don't know where sewer lines are leaking and the water line is leaking in that long expanse of line. I know I have to go and do a repair on the line, but I don't know what else is going on that mile or so of line. So I shut the pressure off. Everything drains down. I go repair it. I don't know what's getting in that line at other locations along there where there's leaking sewer lines, and now I have a water line that had a leak, has no pressure, and that sewage is leaking into it. I repair, I do whatever I'm going to do now, I pressurize the line. That doesn't push that sewage out, it just pushes the sewage down the line. And then again, the instances that I talked about before where for other reasons the pressure in your system goes down. You may have a large mainline break 3 miles away, and before you can get it shut down, it has sucked all the water out of everything that's up above. And so again, you've got a negative pressure up there that is pulling in whatever's next to it if you've got a leak. And you're relying on your chlorinization that's normally in the system, the residual, to take care of that. These are all things that were addressed by the TCQ, and that's why the regulation is the way that it is. The fact of the matter is that the TCQ, or then the TNRCC, has never formally said anything about this. Two people on their staff have given depositions about what their interpretation was. The court did not believe, the trial court did not believe that their reasonings for saying that this small section of the public's sewer system was not regulated for this purpose only, didn't believe the reasoning behind it and said, no, it applies. Those same TCQ officials that testified to that were engineers and said that the TCQ regulation, while it didn't apply as a regulation, stated the engineering standard to be applied and the industry standard. That is the standard. It's the same. And not only that, but in the contracts that were shown to Sherryland before this thing was built, the design engineer put that exact language in there to say that this is how the system was to be built. And the TCQ never came and inspected the project. When they were asked about whether this requirement satisfied it, they showed them the design criteria that was written up by the design engineer, and the TCQ said, yes, that's fine. They were looking at what was, they were being told this is how it's going to be built, but that's not how it was being built. After the fact, the TCQ, the local guys, I mean, the fellows in Austin had already testified, we don't think it applies. And the local guy said, well, then we're not going to get involved in the litigation. I mean, it is what it is. We'll see how it turns out at the end. And in the meantime, that's the way it is. This roll gasket, the only way you roll a gasket, this is not glued pipe. This is gasketed pipe. A gasket sits in a gland in the bell of the pipe. When you take the spigot and you shove it in there, that gasket is supposed to roll over it. If you catch the edge of the pipe on the end of the gasket and you push it out and you have a roll gasket or a fish mouth gasket, The gasket is no longer providing a seal. It only occurs during installation. That was what was found in the one pipe that they found that was leaking. 66 pipes were dug up. One of them had a rolled gasket. That gives some indication that it's going to happen. And that does happen. And so to say that we don't know that it's happening today is ludicrous. We don't know if it's happening today. All we know is no one has come in and sued us because they're sick and said that this is the reason. And finally, 1 minute or two, if I might, on the economic. There was physical damage. Physical encroachment is physical damage. There was an encroachment. They did tear up pipes when they were building it. They fixed them. We didn't sue them for the broken pipes. We sued them for the encroachment. We sued them for the leaking sewage. And we sued them for the denial of unrestrained use. We had an easement right to use our pipe in a certain way and access our pipe in a certain way, and we can't do that now. That's not any different than the Goose Creek case, school district case against Jared Plumbing. I think that you do have physical damage here, and even if you don't and you say, well, there's no third-party beneficiary, so there's no contract, there's no privity, then I think that the economic loss rule should not be applied to preclude a fix. Somehow this system's got to get fixed. It can't be just left the way it is. So I'd ask that you consider these things and overturn the Court of Appeals and reinstate the damages that were awarded by the trial court.
Thank you, Mr. Dyer and counsel. The cause is submitted. That concludes the arguments for this morning. The marshal will adjourn the court.
All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, now stands adjourned.